Hey, it's Kenny from Type of Negative, and you're listening to Behind the Vinyl.
Nice to see. It's always nice to see when someone comes on and they're playing, when they got the guitar in the hands. It's always nice to see.
Well, I'm in my studio. You interrupted my recording process.
I apologize. We apologize for that. We definitely don't want to do that.
It never stops, so it's always an interruption. You know, my wife complains too.
How is the creative process at the moment? Is it for you? Is it always ongoing?
Yeah, it's always ongoing. It's always evolving. Usually, the first idea you had was the best.
Right.
Go down 18 rabbit holes after that. Try to make it better, and you end up going back to the first. And no matter how many years you do it, you never learn that. But there could be something better. It can be a little better. You always think that, and then yeah.
I had a funny thing about Eddie Van Halen, where he used to record every single. I just read this the other day. Actually, he used to record every single interview that he used to do, and this journalist thought that it was because, you know, to make sure that everything was correct, but it wasn't. It was because he always had a guitar in hand. And if he played something during that interview that he liked, he wanted to go back and listen to it so he could get it. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, he was obviously way more above the level of psycho than most artists. You know? I mean, that's why he's Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty obsessive, but that's fucking obsessive.
Yeah. Well, a guy like Eddie Van Halen, I mean, did he have any kind of, you know, influence or had some kind of inspiration on you? And
of course, I mean, yeah. I was his generation, the generation that was listening to him first, and I'm right of the age group. So, yeah. You know, Eruption first came out, I was already listening to Sabbath, Zeppelin and everything, you know, I was already well-versed in everything that was going on in rock and roll. And I knew the impact of it the second I heard it, you know, like everyone did back then. You know, the kids go back, they listen now and it's, you know, it's, oh, it's another distorted guitar, you know, but then it was like, what the hell? This guy's from another planet. You know, of course it influenced me. I was making up my own Eruption when I was like, you know, 14, you know,
cool.
With my PVP 60 and my PV backstage amp, it'll probably cost about $400 between the both of them. Turn the saturation knob all the way up. Get all that static. Yeah, of course, it was an influence on anyone who was playing.
Yeah, yeah.
What about locally? Who was influencing you? Like, because I'm guessing around that time there was probably the. You know, like the Twisted Sisters, the JJ Frenches and all that kind of stuff? Or were you into that kind of stuff?
Well, I was a little too young to see Twisted Sisters when they first started coming off and out of Lemoore, but that's the base. Lemoore was the place that they started from with Mike and George, Loud and Proud Management. Obviously, it's where we got off to. And that was the center of rock and roll in my life, because the first live band I ever saw was Circle Jerks there. I must have been about 14.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
You know, and I just wandered in on a Wednesday afternoon. And then the second band I saw, which really influenced me, was TT Quick. And they were playing they were a local cover band, and they were playing all, at the time they were doing all covers, they were doing all AC/DC and the Bon Scott. And at the time I had just discovered AC/DC through Back in Black and was already going back catalog, you know, for the Bon Scott stuff. And they blew my mind. They sounded just like them. And I was there and then, really. I mean, I was already playing, you know, I was already having little band practices with my friends, but that I was determined when I saw them that this is what I want to do. I got to do this. And I got to do this specifically. I got to get up on this stage at Lemoore and do it, you know. And that was the tunnel vision focus, probably from the time, you know, I was like 14 on. So obviously when we finally conquered all with Type O in 89. We'll be right back.
I read somewhere that you said that you were kind of like the rock version of Saturday Night Fever with L'Amour and what was going on and everything in New York.
Oh, what you mean, L'Amour, as far as L'Amour goes?
Yeah, because I read an interview where you said, like, we were, like, living the rock version of Saturday Night Fever because L'Amour was that club that we all
Correct.
Went to.
Exactly. It was. It's a little microcosm. It just happened to happen in Bay Ridge as well. You know? I mean, that was our world. And then, if you look at Saturday Night Fever, right, believe it or not, Carnivore, when they were first started out, and Carnivore had played 2001 Odyssey, the place where they used to do rock shows like on a Wednesday and Thursday night too. Just a little information, but yes, that became like this huge. I mean, the club was nothing; it was a shithole until the movie 2001, and then it became the center of all disco. And yes, that and then L'Amour evolved into the center of live rock entertainment and metal and what was going on. All the bands, all the biggest. I saw Metallica there. I mean, you know, Ride the Lightning when it was first starting out, you know, and all the bands came through there. All the national acts that were coming up. Slayer first saw there. I mean, I can. The band list goes on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
So L'Amour was the rock capital of like New York for a long time, unless you wanted to see big, huge bands, because that was the intermediate room. You know, to see the cool bands. If you want to see big arena bands, yes, you had to go to the Garden. You had to go whatever. Not even Hammerstein even existed. It was still a shambles.
Right. You know?
That only switched over. L'Amour lost his status when grunge came to be and Ron Delsner started promoting in Manhattan. And he refurbished the Hammerstein Ballroom and he started diverting all the national cool acts to Manhattan.
Oh, wait. Right.
Micah George and L'Amour. And then it was like, oh, that's a hair band club, you know, because there's grunge was in, you know. that was the downfall of the club. But it ruled between like 1983 and all the way up to 91, you know.
Right.
It ruled our world and our focus. We rehearsed with the Sisters 2. We recorded the Sisters 2, but we rehearsed at Sink to Pink. The main place was Sink to Pink. And all the bands rehearsed there. Just there was only two or three rehearsal studios. That was one of the main ones. So everybody rehearsed there. So you got to get this shit ready to conquer L'Amour. You know, once you made it to L'Amour, that's it. You were famous. That it wasn't even the Garden anymore. It was L'Amour for us, you know? Right. That's funny because the first of the bands, the local bands, you know, which I would consider obviously Typo, Biohazard, and Life of Agony. Mm-hmm. Three of them, the first of the ones to break was Biohazard. You know, they cracked the nut of L'Amour. You know, they introduced this whole groove hardcore thing and it exploded. They were packing the room, man. You know, so they were the first to go. And then we were the second, and then LOA. Well, wow. It was great though when we finally cracked the nut of L'Amour and, like, you know, we could come back if the Bloody Kisses, you know, went platinum or even when it went gold. And come back and like sell the room out two nights in a row and be like, to Mike and George, $15,000 a night. What? You're killing me. Yeah. All cash. Good fellas, man. You know, go home. Give the cash to my wife. Here, hide this. The IRS can't get me anymore. It's like 40 years ago. Those are the good old days, man.
Good old days. Yeah. Absolutely. Well,
we'll be right back.
You mentioned Carnivore back there. Pete asked you to join Carnivore originally, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I was very young. I was going back to the same time where I was making up my own Eruption with my little PV T60 and my PV backstage amp, you know, and Louis, Carnivore's drummer, grew up, you know, I grew up with him and used to be in my house all the time and hear me playing. And he mentioned me to Pete, you know, Pete's little brother's getting really good. So I went, they were playing, there was this other club called Zappas. It was right on Quentin Road in East 36th Street. And a lot of famous bands moved through there too when there were nobody. R.E.M. played there, you know, like a bunch of bands when there were nobody, you know.
Right.
And Carnivore used to play there a lot. And they were playing a show and I went there to meet Peter there. You know, he had his whole Fred Flintstone's Carnivore outfit on with the shoulder pads. I was about maybe 90 pounds. I was 14 years old, you know. I didn't even grow to my average height yet of 5'10". He was already, you know, whatever, 6'6". And I stood in front of him and I looked up. I was like, oh, shit. And he looked down and he went, you got a Marshall stack. And I went, you got to work out. And he walked away. And that was my rejection. Who knew that, you know, nearly a decade later, we would end up having an entire career together. I mean, as you get older, that age gap closes a little more.
Yeah. How did it come full circle? Did he remember when you hooked up for Typo? Did he remember?
No, he didn't remember that story.
He didn't remember that.
He knew my brother. He remembered my brother, and he vaguely knew that, you know, he had a little brother. That's it.
Wow. Wow.
We did talk to Johnny, and one thing he said with Typo, it was always kind of, you were always kind of hanging on a thread, you know, like.
Oh, yeah. I think all bands are, but I think more so with Typo, because with your average rock band or musician, they really want to be rock stars. They really want to go for it all. We were the opposite, you know, trying to shoot ourselves in the foot, blow it up all the time. I mean, he didn't want to be famous. You know, I mean, he didn't mind being famous. He liked being famous, but like he didn't want to do it on his own time from his basement in his house. Didn't want to leave Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know, these were his requirements. You know, he hated playing live shows. You know, he just felt like, you know, he always had like, I don't know, a piece of snot hanging on his nose and people were looking at it. And, you know, he felt like a big dick in his own words, you know. Yeah. So he hated playing live shows. He liked making music. He liked going to the studio, you know. So we had that. We had that in unique. I guess it's not completely unique. I'm sure there's other artists out there that have been through this, you know. But he didn't want to feed the engine and be famous and do whatever it takes. You know, he was the only guy I know in history that asked to be paid to do interviews.
Right. Wow.
Getting paid to promote your own career. Yeah. He didn't get it. You know, I'm doing this so I can sell more. He didn't get it. No, I want to be paid. This is my time. That's what we were dealing with. You know, it's like a very unique person. And you had to deal with that, you know, that those kind of trips and, you know.
Was that a contradiction to the Kenny that's probably looking at Eddie Van Halen up there and trying to emulate Eddie? Was that a contradiction to what you wanted? Did you want to be famous? Did you want to get out there and play the big shows?
Of course I did. Yes. Yeah. I mean, at that point when I met Peter, I was already doing it since I was like 12, right? I was about 24. It was now or never. And Josh was even worse. Josh was like 5 years older. I'm old. I can't. I got to make it now. I'm old. You know? He was already, when I met Josh, it was like he was 90. And I think he was 28. So it was like, who was the last chance for romance band? You know what I mean? Sal was the youngest one. He was whatever, 3 years younger than me. So he was the baby.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, so it was like sort of like, yeah, last chance for romance. Let's get this ball rolling. And, you know, the ball was 6'6" and weighed 250 pounds. And we couldn't get him down the goddamn block over the bridge.
Jeez. Hollow Sea.
saints. Buy me the price, but then nothing is free. My soul I'll gladly free.
Album covers for Slow Deep and Hard and the Origin of the Feast and stuff like that. How do you present that to a record label?
Well, the original record cover for Slow Deep and Hard, which was distorted, you know, was fizzed out, you know, and grainy.
Yeah.
Was easy. You can get away with it easy, you know.
Yeah.
Good sales, you know, it is what it is, but you can get away with it in Kmart, right?
Right.
But they didn't know what it was until, you know, I remember the picture, Peter cut it out. It was a porn picture from, you know, one of those, whatever, porn magazines from the 80s. And I remember him saying, tell me the idea. I want to turn this into the album cover, you know, and just distort it or whatever, and pixelate it. So we did it. Nobody knew what it was. You know, he had to explain it. You know, and I remember they had a memo going around in Roadrunner to all the people. It's a penis! With to try to explain to everybody it was a penis. Now, Origin of the Feast is a little different. You know, that was like right off the cuff thing. It happened in the studio while we were recording it. And Systems, I think it was Systems One. It might have been Systems One, the first room they had. The photographer at the time, I forget his name, but he didn't want his name known anyway. The guy who took the picture. And we had all these baffles set up because we were doing it the old style way where we're playing this record live. And, you know, we had just sound panels between us to try to control the bleed and stuff. And I remember going, here, come here. I got a picture for you. And he went behind the drum panels, the drum set where the sound panels were. And this guy was kind of short, I remember, too. And he ran up behind Peter, behind. They disappeared behind the panels for a few seconds. I had no idea what was happening. Until I saw the picture on the record, I realized. I remember when it came out, he was horrified, the kid. He was like, oh, he goes, you could use the picture as long as you don't put my name on it. So, an on the fly thing, you know, and I, of course, went along with the title really well. I like that better than the original, is better than the alternative woman
right.
cover, you know.
Well, different times. I mean, compared to today.
Yeah, I think you could get away with an asshole still today. You just can't get away with other stuff.
Right, yeah.
How we said and did. All of it, obviously. But, yeah, I don't think you could ever get away with an asshole, you know, Kmart or Walmart. But
No.
The other, this is great. You know, what is funny is like this band is, seems to be transcending to a younger generation. And I was in Jimmy Duff's bar, Duff's in Brooklyn, for this memorial they had. They have usually a little thing for PETA, you know, on this anniversary. And these really young girls, like in their 20s, I mean, as old as my youngest daughter, you know, very cute and asking me questions and all this stuff. And then one young girl goes, oh, by the way, the picture on Origin of Feces, is that really Peter's butt? And I looked at her and went, yeah. And she looked for a minute, like, I don't know, sort of like if her imagination was just destroyed. So like, oh, I guess you really just never know what people have down there. Oh, I guess you never know.
No.
Right, we call it. Left is not dead. Point that finger.
We don't care what you think. We don't care
what you think. Oh, 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 oh. Oh, 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 oh. Ground is sensitive. Label breaking. It's a mirror. Say that.
rebellious. And you take on that we are racist. Well, shit, shit, shit comes in all use. Now this leaves you pushing in all ways like they seem. Like they seem.
When the success come, considering Peter, he wanted to stay back there. When the success come, how did you guys all take that? Did you welcome it?
There was never a moment of shining success. It was never like, we made it. We're on the cover of Rolling Stone. We played Madison Square Garden. That shit never happened.
Hmm.
So it was always like, we got a platinum record.
Hmm.
Right? But we weren't millionaires, you know? The industry was all changing. File sharing started, you know, so the money started dwindling right away for intermediate level bands like us.
Yeah.
You know, so it was always like halfway up the ladder, get knocked down four rungs. You know what I mean? The whole career was like that.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed to be, it was rough, almost making it up, getting shot down, almost making it up, getting shot down. And then it kind of leveled off when the 2000s came in and said, all right, you ain't getting any bigger than this. You ain't going down all the way. You ain't dying for some reason. And you ain't going any further up. So it was just, you know, it kind of leveled off.
But did you feel it when you come to Europe? Because I can remember seeing you maybe 98 or 99 or something at Dynamo, you know, and you must have felt it like, you know, because everyone's from, like, you know, you're just a band from, you know, New York, and then you come over and you're playing a fucking 80,000 people at Dynamo Festival. That must have been...
It was like 150, but yeah, that was incredible. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think we, Doggy Dog, we shared the stages? I don't remember. Is it one of
the bands? I think Doggy Dog might have been there, yeah.
Yeah, that might have been a band, right? Yeah. But
it was definitely a Belgian band. Belgian band, yeah.
That was a great, you know, time. Yeah, but like, I don't know. We always fit. Back then, it was like the idea was, all you have to do is be from America and you could be big in Europe. You know what I mean? So being big in Europe was not making it, you know. Let me shut this down. So it was great. It was amazing. But still, I think being American, I would have wanted to see us on the cover of Rolling Stone or us playing Madison Square Garden. Those are the markers, right? Yep. For rock artists, for American artists, for any artists, right? I mean, it was a great moment walking out on stage in front of 150,000 people at Dynamo, hitting one chord and saying, thank you, good night, and walking off. You were there for that, right? We stood off for like a full 10 minutes until we felt like the vibe in the audience started going really black, you know, and they started getting angry. Then we went back on.
what about recording the records? Like, again, we talked to Johnny and he kind of said, yeah, he was obviously only on Dead Again. But he said by the end of recording it, he was like, oh, like, I need to get away. You know, we all needed to get away, a little bit of a away from everything. What was it like recording the records for you?
Imponderous, mostly, especially later on. Like, in the beginning, it was ponderous in a way where you had to rehearse the hell out of it because we were playing it live for the most part, right? And very complicated music. I mean, just think about So Deep in Heart, 70 minutes of music, you know, with all these freaking different timing signatures and, you know, immense. I mean, I don't know how, you know, I remembered or learned all that. I couldn't do it today, I'll tell you that. Hmm. So a little, it ponders in that way, where you had to rehearse, which is what I was used to back then, rehearsing. And then get it done for the record. It all had to be done quick because we were broke. And the technology wasn't there yet. Pro Tools wasn't there, none of that. When Pro Tools came involved, now everything started becoming very much more of a slow process, right? Now you're playing everything to a click or you know, to a drum machine to get the tracks down. You're redoing the tracks. You're doing them sort of perfect. And then the album cycles, the album creation part of it became longer and longer, you know? From Bloody Kisses was a little bit longer. We were still kind of done with a live, you know, application, and then, you know, it started getting more lengthy with October Rust, which actually October Rust was pounded out, I will admit, because we had no time. It was at the peak of our career. We just had a gold album that's going platinum. We had to follow up and beat it. We had all these offers to go on the road, so we just done sandwiched between tours, you know. After that, the process came really long, you know, because it could be. You know, if you don't have a deadline and you could keep doing things over and over because you're not paying money, you're doing it because we did the pre-production at Josh's house. You know, at that point, we were doing all the tracks, pre-production, layers at Josh's house, and then just mixing and mastering at Systems 2, which makes sense because it cost money to do that. And now we had the technology to do it at home. You know, so the process definitely got longer. After 2000, after 99, from 99 on.
Yeah. I mean, looking at your catalog, I mean, is there one album that stands out for you that you're, you know, either your favorite or the album where everything just clicked? And
I don't know if any album where everything just clicks, but my favorite, personal favorites are Slow, Deep, and Hard and World Coming Down. And right. I think it's because of the honesty of the records.
Right.
More so the lyrics, the honesty, than, you know, the performances, blah, 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 you know, the writing, whatever. I mean, these are really, really, really stark confessional records. And that's the kind of stuff I'm attracted to. You know,
yeah.
That's stuff I'm proud to play. There's a lot of that stuff throughout. You know, I'm not taking anything away from the other records. Bloody Kisses is a great record. You know, Christian Woman's probably the best song Peter ever wrote, you know.
Right. Yeah.
When you think about it, pound for pound, at the length of the song, the amount of pop hooks that are in it and heavy riffs. He felt the same way anyway about that song.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, collectively as records, probably those are my two favorite records. Can I sit and listen to them both without a gun in my mouth? Probably not. I tell you, here at Dead Again, like Jimmy at the bar, his bar plays it often, and I forget how good it is, you know, because these records, like things like Dead Again, we never toured extensively, played the whole record for decades like we did all the other records, you know, so you forget.
Yeah.
The track list, really.
Yeah.
I don't listen to it. Sit down and listen to the music I've done my whole career, ever.
You know? Right.
So if you didn't play it 1,000 times, you know, or you don't hear it on the radio 1,000 times, you know, you just forget it. And then it's a nice surprise to hear it. So, all right, all that friggin' rigorous going to the friggin' studio 5 nights a week and dragging Peter out of his house and dealing with him wasted, and, you know, all that stuff was worth it. It's a great record.
Yeah, hell yeah. We'll be right back. thing is pretty cool with October Rust. Like, now it's social media. Every year when 1st of October comes around, there's tons of people posting either Love You to Death or just posting the whole album of October Rust. It's become a thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're the Halloween band. We are the Autumn Rust band.
Yeah.
I really, you know, when this time of year comes around, you know, I miss the band more than anything. Because we'd be out right now playing Worcester, you know, Massachusetts or whatever. We do our Halloween run, you know, we play Detroit and the Roseland when it existed here, you know, go down maybe to Baltimore and make some money and have a great time. And people will show up just because it's Halloween. Didn't matter if we had a record out or what, you know.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
She'd like to know. God.
What do you tell your kids when you explain to them about what it was like back then? You obviously must have lots of fond memories, but like you said, it was all hanging on a wire. But you must look back on it and just say that was a pretty incredible time. Now,
oh yeah, yes, absolutely. My oldest remembers a little bit. You know, my oldest was born in '97. I remember Ozfest '97. I had her as an infant out on stage. I remember Ozzy playing with her. Go, hey, little guy, me. She's a rock and roll kid. She was kind of born in, even when she was like maybe 3-5 years old, whatever, she just come on the bus, hang out, you know. But my youngest doesn't remember. She remembers me going on tour and disappearing for long interim, 6-week intervals and stuff. But yeah, they love the stories, you know. I mean, yeah. They know I was an asshole, jerk off, lunatic, you know. I mean, you go online and fucking, you can just Google and you can see all kinds of stupid shit I've done. There's no use hiding it, right?
Oh. So,
and plus, when you live with me, you can't hide it. I can't hide it at all. I'm sober now, but, you know, for most of their childhood, I wasn't, you know. I was never like mean or anything like that or abusive to my family, but I was, you know, a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
So, you know. I mean, it's rock and roll. You know. I can't take it back. Some of the stuff I'd like to take back, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
It's all been documented.
As we talked to Johnny, I mean, he said that when Peter passed, that he wasn't, well, was he surprised? I can't even remember, Darren. Was he surprised or he wasn't surprised?
He was surprised because
it was clean.
Sober. Yeah. I think it was expected. You guys were expecting Pete to die throughout the whole career of Typo, but actually when he did pass, it was actually when he was probably the healthiest and the soberest, right?
Yeah, in a while. Yeah. Yeah, he was maybe about 8 months, something like that. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time, I was the one most likely to die. And then it switched over to him. So we're always waiting for somebody to die, you know. And after a while, it starts feeding into this mythology of maybe he's indestructible. That's why that's what gave birth to the cover of Dead Again. Of Rasputin. Right. I used to call him Rasputin. You know, because he'd get drunk and then you give him cyanide, all of the stuff. You can't kill him. He had a foot long penis, you know, and he was dancing on the table. I was Peter. So I just called him Rasputin. That's how it ended up becoming the cover, you know. And right. then that starts feeding into this mythology. And then suddenly, reality check, and you realize we're all mortal, you know, and everyone can die and everyone will, you know.
Yeah. So
it's a shock.
Yeah.
Well, if you were sober, were you sober at that time as well, or were you still?
No, I just got sober. I have 2 years and 9 months now.
Okay. Wow. Well done, Matt. So, well done now.
I was kind of like, I was more, I can't say I was more controlled. I was out off the rocker, you know, a lot. But like, there was times where I had to be more controlled because I had kids and a wife. You beat it in. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
yeah.
I would come back home and it'd be on like a beer only diet, you know, something like that, you know? And when I was away, I'd, you know, lose my mind. So, you know, I'm lucky to be here, too. So, you know, I'm grateful, to be here. And I love being sober. You know, I should have did this 20 years ago. I don't know why. I think you get used to being a certain way. You get used to, you build a reward system in your life, whatever it is. Sex, food, you know, whatever. Beautiful women, rock and roll. For most of my life, since I was 12, my reward, one of my main reward systems was booze.
Yeah.
You know, so to change that is a very, very, very hard thing. It's a very big thing. You know, look at me. It took me 54 years. So, you know, but you can. You can switch your reward system to other things, you know.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Now it's all hollow. Moon is full. Or will she trick or treat? I bet she will. Every day is Halloween.
Was like
Well, dude, we talked to Johnny about that as well. But the 94 tour that you guys did with Motley Crue, any funny memories from that tour?
Oh, a million, man. That was probably, you know, you say this is the apex of the band's career, which I would say probably was around Dynamo Festival when you were talking about before. But really, for me, that was because that at that point in time, we didn't have a career. We had nothing to lose, nothing to maintain. So we just had every minute to enjoy. So that was really rock and roll summer camp. We had never played a shed or an outdoor arena or an indoor arena.
Right.
We'd never been on an arena tour, you know. We came from like playing to 50 people a night in small dive bars, which we're having a great time doing that too. So suddenly, you know, we didn't want to do it. We were like, we can't open up for Motley Crue. Are you crazy? We're going to get booed off the stage. It was quite the opposite. You know, that's how we found out, like, the flexibility of the band, you know. And they weren't doing so well because it was a Karabi record, so the fans weren't taking well to Karabi, whatever. You know, they had their problems. It wasn't a lot of people there for them, but there was like 5,000, 6,000 people there for us. I mean, you know, and we didn't have beer on our rider, so we would just go into their dressing room and steal their beer every night.
You're right.
You know? All right, we had a great time. You know,
yeah.
What a great tour. What a great time. That's what made the band's career. It just started our career.
Right.
Before that, we were selling nothing. Nobody knew who the hell we were.
Right.
You know, we did the Motley Crue tour and suddenly we were selling like 2,000 records a week.
Wow.
You know, boom. Right up. You know, my Ken Creedy, my brilliant manager, was right. You're going to be playing in front of people that would never think about buying your album or even going to see you. And that's how you sell records. He was right. It worked. And that started the ball rolling. And Queensryche asked us to come out. Danzig asked us to come out. Pantera, you know, then the ball really started rolling. Best time of my life.
Yeah.
Who was it in Motley Crue? Because we understand it was the band that asked. What did you ever find out? Was it Tommy Lee? I could imagine it's Tommy Lee or someone that asked, because I understand it was the band that asked for you guys.
Yeah, it was Tommy, I think. And they were listening to Bloody Kisses while they were making the Karabi record in the studio.
Right.
And digging it. So cool. Collectively, Nikki Sixx, I think, was the one who really asked us.
Nice.
And you're sporting the ink of Type O. So you can never shed that skin. You can never shed that that Type O.
But this is a pretty common tattoo.
Yeah.
A lot of people, man, like, come up to me. I got one.
But it is like that. It's like that, or like a misfit skull or something that's everywhere. But
yeah.
But have you ever like wanted to shed it, you know, and get rid of the owner, or you've always been happy to be Kenny from Type O?
Well, I have this idea of, first of all, I got the tattoo right away. The band, yep. I didn't even think we made the first record. You know, all right, this is the band who's gonna do it, we're gonna do it, we're all gonna get a tattoo, fine.
Yeah.
You know. And I'm sort of like a guy who sort of wears his mistakes, you know, on his shoulder, you know,
yeah,
in view for people to see, because I feel like everybody's a fuck up. You know, everyone's got something to hide. I'm going to fucking spend my life hiding. I mean, certain things I'd like to hide. But the point is it's part of my life. It's part of my history. It's part of who I am. You know what I mean? I'm trying to hide it. It's just lame, you know.
Yeah.
This has been done. This is it. You know, I'm going to take it away. You know, it's a time and place. I mean, I got other horrible tattoos too. I'll never change them.
Yeah.
I'm not embarrassed of them. Yeah. They all have a memory, a special drunken memory of some stupid place. I got them all for free, by the way. So.
And lastly, it's so great that we're sitting in 2022 on the verge of 2023 and the desire for your music is still around. You know, again, it's being re-released.
Best thing.
Still hungry for it. And over here in Sweden, it's, you know, we can't get enough of it, you know, because it's in such demand over here. So that must really make you feel pretty proud.
Oh, very, very, very. It makes me feel vindicated that we kind of like always stuck to our guns, you know.
Yeah.
And never like sold out or try to jump on any trend. You know, what a lot of artists do when they start, you know, just getting to the precipice, you know, and they want to get over that last hump. So we never did that, you know, and it was harder. Our careers were hard because of it.
Yeah.
But in the end, we have like some staying power and some longevity, and we're transcending and people picking up on that, you know, and that's great, man. It's very, very satisfying.
Hell yeah. Love it.
We're done, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.